Following program comes to you as part of the Africa Health Network, a service of the Voice of America to our audience throughout the African continent.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Lenore Moudou, and welcome to Health Chat. How aware are you that the environment you live in, work, or spend time can affect your health? Well, experts say the environment plays a significant role in one's well-being and development. For example, certain chemical substances found in the air or water have been linked to various diseases. One such substance is mercury. It is a toxic natural element that can cause brain and neurological damage, especially among children. Well, today we will discuss the link between health and the environment with a focus on mercury. Joining us via phone from Durban, South Africa, is Rico Europidou. He's environmental epidemiologist and health scientist and research manager with Groundwork, a non-profit environmental justice service organization based in Pietermaritzburg in South Africa. Rico Europidou, welcome to the program.
Thank you, and hello to you and all your listeners.
Great. Thank you for joining us. And let me remind the audience that if you would like to participate in the show with your question or comment, you can call us at 202-619-3111. The U.S. country code is 1. And of course, you can ask your international operator to reverse the charges. You can also email us your thoughts or questions at healthchat@voanews.com or post your questions on Facebook/healthchat. We'll start discussing health and environment in a moment with an emphasis on mercury. But first, experts recently met in Geneva for the world's first treaty to reduce toxic mercury emissions and use of mercury. Lisa Schlein has the story.
After all-night talks, negotiators toasted each other with champagne early Saturday to celebrate their achievement. The treaty, which has been under negotiation for 4 years, provides controls and reductions across a range of products and processes where mercury is used, released, and emitted. The treaty, known as the Minamata Convention on Mercury, is named after a city in Japan where serious health damage occurred as a result of mercury pollution in the mid-20th century. Mercury is a toxic element which occurs in nature. Just over 2,000 tons of mercury are emitted into the air from human activity every year, increasing the threat to human health and the environment. Executive Director of the United Nations Environment Program, Achim Steiner, says mercury is used widely in many sectors. It is found in the medical and pharmaceutical industries, in batteries and lighting, in everyday products, such as skin creams and soap.
And it took us a long time to both establish and understand that in expanding this use by human beings, we were creating a terrible legacy because mercury accumulates. It accumulates in the food chain through fish, for instance. It accumulates in our bodies. It is released through the burning of coal-fired power stations and travels sometimes thousands of kilometers. It affects the Inuit in Canada, just as it affects the small-scale artisanal gold miner somewhere in southern Africa.
The treaty includes measures for controlling and phasing out the use of mercury. Under the treaty, governments agree to ban the production, export, and import of a range of products containing mercury by 2020. Mercury is harmful to health. It can cause brain and neurological damage, especially among children. Other effects include kidney damage and damage to the digestive system. Victims can suffer memory loss and language impairment. UNEP says coal burning and small-scale gold mining are the major sources of mercury emissions into the air. The booming price of gold is triggering a significant growth in small-scale mining, especially in impoverished communities in Africa and Asia. Up to 15 million people work in this industry, including 3 million women and children. The head of UNEP's chemical branch, Tim Kasten, says mercury is used to separate gold from the ore-bearing rock. Unfortunately, he says, this process is very harmful to health.
So what we'd like to do is to help them understand the hazards of mercury, get them to reduce the amount of mercury they're using, either through very low technology devices that are called retorts, which is actually a way of recycling or distilling the mercury that they're using, such that they can recover between 80 and 90% of the mercury that they're using. So they can use that mercury again, so they don't have to pay for the mercury. At the same time, it's not being emitted to the air.
The treaty calls upon nations that have artisanal and small-scale gold mining operations to draw up national plans within 3 years of the treaty going into force. The aim is to reduce and, if possible, eliminate the use of mercury in such operations. The treaty will be open for signature at a special meeting in Japan in October. It will take effect after 50 countries have ratified it. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And Mr. Rico, again, welcome to the show. You actually attended the Mercury Convention in Geneva. Can you give us a sense of how the discussions went?
Well, I think it's important to know that in the context of global environmental governance, where countries aren't really in favor of having multilateral environmental agreements and having, broad sort of regulations that curtail the perception of, industrial development and progress, this is a very important treaty. It's going against the grain of what the global trend is as far as having, global agreements. So we think that's very important, and I think that needs to be recognized, that this is a problem that countries all have a very unified general agreement on, that it needs to be regulated. And overall, this global agreement is an important step that we're taking forward in protecting public health and the environment. However, we think that some areas of the treaty are a little bit weak, and the provisions as they stand are not strong enough to prevent and reduce global mercury emissions. And that's what this treaty is meant to do. It is meant to reduce global mercury emissions to the extent that we mitigate these global public health impacts. And we don't think that the treaty quite does enough in that regard.
So then can you give us an example specifically as to where one of the weaknesses is in the treaty?
Absolutely. The treaty, the way treaties are structured is that they are divided into different articles, and those different articles cover the various thematic areas that need to be controlled. So there's an article on coal-fired power plants, and generally that article is titled emissions. Emissions, it's Article 10 in the treaty, and it covers these big installations that burn lots of coal. We heard in the clip Achim Steiner talking about how important their global contribution is. It covers also, various other categories like metal smelters and things like that. So they burn huge amounts of coal, and the trace amounts of mercury in that coal have a big global contribution, making it one of the biggest source contributors in the global environment. Now, the provision, as it stands, says that when the treaty comes into force, any new plant following the ratification of the treaty, so a new coal-fired power station is defined as a new plant, will have to adopt what's called BAT, the best available technology, the best environmental practice in order to mitigate mercury pollution. And that's great. However, we have existing plants on a huge scale. In China, we have over 1,000 existing coal-fired power stations. We have many in India. We have many in many other jurisdictions around the world. And the provisions in order to try and address mercury pollution from existing plants is very weak. It gives a country too much flexibility. In fact, the language is so structured that if a country didn't want to do anything about existing plants, the language is control and, where feasible, reduce emissions of mercury. So if a country decides that it's simply not feasible to do it, then what happens?
Yes.
It doesn't do anything. And there's a menu of options that allows the country to choose one of the following options. And quite frankly, that menu of options is so wide open that if a country decided to meaningfully not do anything about this, then it wouldn't do anything about it. And that is counterintuitive to what the treaty sets out to do. The countries that negotiated this treaty got together with the recognition that they needed to control mercury. And quite frankly, they didn't take strong enough steps in order to do everything they could to begin to address mercury in for new sources and for existing sources.
But would you say that this is a step in the right direction, though, just to have this first convention?
In the right direction.
Yes.
And if countries so choose to, once they've ratified the treaty, the countries will meet on a cyclical basis in something that's called the COP, the Conference of the Parties. They can, if they so will, and have the political will to do so, they can begin to change the provisions within the treaty. They can make some provisions stronger, and they can take the collective decision to take more forceful action in order to control mercury from priority sources, such as coal-fired power plants.
Okay. Now, mercury is a toxic element, and it seems to be, from the report and from what I've read, mercury really seems to be everywhere in our daily lives. So when you look at Africa specifically, I know we mentioned gold mining in the report. It's one of the reasons around which the convention was held to see how to regulate that industry. But can you tell us about some of the different ways how humans are being exposed to mercury?
Well, you know, having listened to the clips, it was quite interesting that one of the very sort of basic principles of mercury exposure and mercury contamination in humans wasn't necessarily expanded on. Mercury is a special element because in our bodies it does things that other contaminants can't really do. It does two special things. One is it can cross the placental barrier. So any woman who is pregnant and has a developing child in her body, when she's exposed to mercury, whether it's because she's eaten fish that have been contaminated with mercury and it's bioaccumulated up the food chain, or whether she is working in an artisanal small-scale gold mining operation where they've used mercury to amalgamate the gold out of the ore, and then what they do is they use a Bunsen burner or a flame. They maybe heat up a plate with the gold that's amalgamated in the mercury over a plate to melt away the mercury. When people are exposed and that mercury enters into your body, it's able to cross these barriers. One is the placental barrier and the other one is the blood-brain barrier. And that is how mercury affects us. It affects the development of the fetus as it goes through its critical phases of development. And we've seen from the history of mercury contamination that these developmental impacts can be very, very huge and quite, you know, shocking visually. In a place called Minamata, where they expecting to ratify this treaty in a diplomatic convention in October. There was a case of mercury poisoning in the 1950s, and the children that were born to women who were exposed to mercury were born with gross congenital anomalies. These were birth defects that meant that these children weren't able to talk and couldn't use their limbs. They were described as wooden dolls at the time. So big exposure to mercury can have very big adverse impacts on the developing child and subsequent, you know, when those children are born, they have these gross congenital malformations. And if you are exposed to too much mercury, if you breathe it in and it crosses your blood-brain barrier, it can begin to affect you neurologically. You can begin to have peripheral neurological effects, such as you can, you know, you develop the shakes. There's a funny saying from history that is mad as a hatter. It appears in Alice in Wonderland, and the hatters in old England were the people who used to make felt hats, these big top hats, and in order to soften the felt, they would use mercury. Hmm. And eventually, through occupational exposure, these people became mad. And that's where the expression comes from, mad as a hatter. You are as mad as a hatter.
Interesting.
So this is what happens in occupational exposure. So people who work in artisanal small-scale gold mining, who use mercury to amalgamate the gold and melt it away once they have their gold lumps, they can breathe in this mercury, and it can affect them neurologically.
Okay. And Mr. Rico, we will talk more about this, the exposure, especially with the gold mining. But we have to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk more about this issue.
What's up, Africa? I'm Jackson Bungani in Washington.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America.
Listen, we need to discuss what's going on in your communities, issues that affect you.
Are you involved?
Are you engaged in transforming your society?
Today, right now, this is your platform.
Let us know what you've been up to.
Check us out on Facebook. Drop us a line.
It's Upfront Wednesdays at 17:30 UTC
right here on VOA Africa.
Feast with your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best. Right here on VOA Africa.
Welcome back. For those of you joining us late, tonight's topic on Health Chat is health and environment, and we are focusing on mercury. Joining us via phone from South Africa, Durban, is Rico Uripidu. He's research manager with Groundwork, a nonprofit of environmental justice service organization based in Pietermaritzburg, South Africa. And a reminder that you can join our conversation by sending us your email at healthchat@voanews.com or send us your question on Facebook/healthchat. And we do have a question from Lisa on Facebook. She wrote this question. How do you get rid of mercury in fish? Rico?
Yep.
Yes.
That's a really tricky question. And it's tricky for a variety of reasons, because I think we need to put it into context. Fish is something that we don't want to discourage people from eating. We want people to eat fish because fish is healthy for them, and it has huge public health benefits, and those public health benefits are well known and categorized all over the world. But you don't want people to eat contaminated fish. So it's important for us to know what fish are contaminated. And, you know, there's a new global picture that's emerging. There's many groups around the world, scientific groups. One of them is a group based in the USA. It's called the BMI, Biological Monitoring Research Institute. And what they've been doing is testing fish from all over the world, and they've been very progressive about how they've been doing it. They've been involving lots of different scientific and research groups in lots of different jurisdictions, lots of NGOs, and they've been testing lots of different types of fish to try and get a global picture of what fish are the most contaminated fish. And the global picture that emerges is that it's big predatory fish that are generally the most contaminated, and these include fish like marlin, They include fish like Pacific bluefin tuna, like king mackerel, swordfish, big eye tuna. So it's generally fish that are at the top of the food chain that have the highest levels of mercury. And generally, this is consistent throughout the world. So it means that the pollution in fish is pretty uniformly spread. But as you get to, you know, smaller fish, more local fish, you generally find that the mercury contamination is not that high, provided there is no local source of contamination. So, for instance, if there's no factory or contaminated site that keeps contaminating, giving mercury that allows mercury to enter into the food chain, if there isn't that sort of construct, then those fish are generally not contaminated. So the idea for the public is that they need to check what the fish advisories are. You can look on the internet, and generally where you live in places like Europe or the USA, you can check local public health fish advisories, and they will give you good information about which fish is safe to eat, which fish isn't safe to eat, and how often you can eat fish that might be a little bit contaminated. It might have a little bit of mercury in it.
How much mercury, what is the level of mercury that is needed, if I can say that, before it becomes harmful? Is there a quantity?
Well, there is. And you know, again, this is where there's an interesting global picture that's emerging. There's some recent research that looked at the current national and international limits of mercury levels in fish. And in some places in the world, like the U.S., there is, you know, a limit, what the U.S. EPA generally call a reference dose. So the general rule of thumb is that 0.5 parts per million for most fish and 1 part per million for large predatory fish are the enforcement levels. So these are the levels at which the Food and Drug Administrations and agencies, you know, they generally check the fish to see if they comply with that. And if they do, they generally consider that fish safe. But as we have more sensitive tools to evaluate and understand what the public health impact of mercury is, so what is the impact to an entire population that's eating mercury, that is eating fish that might be contaminated with mercury? As that research becomes more refined and we better understand it, we begin to see an even more worrying picture. And that worrying picture is that these reference doses that have been considered safe in the past, and these, you know, tolerable weekly intake references that we've been considering safe in the past, are not necessarily safe, and that there is an adverse population level effect that is happening even at and below these levels. And this is where it's interesting, because what mercury does is it affects the development of the brain. So if you have an entire population of children who are exposed to mercury and are affected by mercury, and we quantify that for any contamination, we can say that it has small impacts on their IQ, say maybe 5 or 6 IQ points. If you shift an entire population's IQ points backwards because of a population exposure, and that means that in your population, you will have that many more million kids who have special needs, that million more kids who maybe won't go on to university. So the population impact is great, even though the exposures are very small.
Okay.
And I think the science is showing that even consumption of small amounts of mercury can cause big impacts on the population.
Okay. Now, there is Dayu from Nigeria. He sends an email, and his question is, I live in a region, in Nigeria, I live in a region where there is continued exploitation of oil and gas. To what extent am I at risk of being affected by mercury?
In the production of oil and gas, there is mercury as a byproduct, especially with gas, for instance. So when the gas is cleaned, when it comes out of the ground, before, you know, once that gas enters into the process where it becomes cleaned and all of that, generally they take the mercury out of the gas. So that means that those facilities will have mercury. The question is, what do they do with that mercury? It's called byproduct mercury. Do they sell the mercury on to artisanal small-scale gold miners who might use it in the field and might use it irresponsibly so that it becomes environmental contamination? Do they clean the mercury, or is it just part of their waste? And where does that waste stream go to? All of these are important questions that you need to answer.
Okay.
In the oil industry, when they refine oil, generally the emissions of mercury go out into the atmosphere. And once mercury goes out into the atmosphere, it begins to circulate globally. It will have local deposits. It will deposit locally depending on what the local meteorology is. But generally what it does is it goes into the global environment.
Okay. Now, what can be done to reduce the risks to human health?
Well, we have to control mercury. That is the most important thing for us to do. We have to control mercury in a way that it doesn't go out into the environment. And like we heard in the clip, it doesn't circulate globally and gets deposited in the Arctic, where there's no industrial activity and where people who, you know, rely on indigenous people like the Inuit people who live in the polar regions, in the circumpolar regions, you know, it doesn't affect them and affect their livelihoods, their subsistence livelihoods, because they eat a lot of fish and they eat a lot of seafood that is at the top of the food chain. So we need to give meaning to this treaty, and in order to do that, we need countries to take uniform actions, to take progressive actions, and we need countries to ratify this treaty and to begin to implement the treaty. Unfortunately, as far as multilateral environmental conventions is concerned, we have the Basel Convention, you know, to control the transboundary movement of hazardous waste. What evidence do we have that it's being effective in Africa? We have very poor evidence. We have electronic waste that's been dumped in Nigeria and in Ghana. We see pictures of children burning computers on, you know, open burning in landfill sites in order to extract the copper and the precious metals.
Okay.
You know, we see pictures, horrific pictures in China of computer boards, chipboards being put in acid to drain out, you know, the precious metals.
Okay,
we need to make it meaningful.
Okay, and we're running out of time. So the final word would be to ratify the treaty.
Ratify the treaty and from the ground up to implement the provisions of the treaty.
Thank you so much, Mr. Rico, for joining us today.
And thank you for having me on your show.
Great. And that's all the time we have for this edition of Health Chat. Rico Uripidu, environmental epidemiologist and health scientist and research manager with Groundwork, a nonprofit environmental justice service organization based in Pietermaritzburg, South Africa, was our guest today. For more on health and the environment, log on to our website at voanews.com/health. Thank you for joining us, producer Jackson Vungani, and special thanks to all our affiliates stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Lenor Mudu, in Washington. Until next time, take care, be well, and strive to make every day a healthy day.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.